Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. Now, last week, you might recall, we encountered what the late David Stove from the philosophy department at Sydney University referred to as the worst argument in the world. And in particular, we encountered it in its most refined form, which he referred to as the gem. Here's a reminder of what we heard. I'm talking to James Franklin and Peter Slezak from the University of New South Wales.
Yes, this is the idealist philosopher George Berkeley, who concluded that there isn't anything out there to see, that you are trapped in your own experience. And his argument, which Stove calls the gem, is that the mind is deluded to think it can and does conceive of bodies existing unthought of or outside the mind, though at the same time they are apprehended by or exist in itself. So you cannot have trees outside the mind in mind without having them in mind. Therefore, Berkeley says, it must, in a sense, be an imagined tree. There are no unimagined trees.
Peter, do you go along with rejecting the good Bishop Berkeley's...
I do, but for me what's interesting about it is that I've been looking at forms that the argument takes in modern psychology and cognitive science. I think Jerry Fodor and leading philosophers who are talking about cognition end up with a version of Berkeley's idealism when they try to explain how cognition could function when it has representations, as they now call them, instead of ideas, as the empiricists call them. And the problem becomes all over again, how to connect the representations with the world, or how to connect us with the world, because of the intermediaries that are our representations, or in Berkeley's case, the ideas. And it's very interesting for me to see how contemporary, sophisticated, technical philosophy of cognitive science essentially rehearses the arguments of Berkeley and Malebranche and these others.
The man responsible for the argument was George Berkeley. He was born in 1685, died in 1753, and he was responsible for what is in many ways a very strange theory. And here's a famous story about it. The year is 1763, the writer is James Boswell, and he's talking about the great subject of his work of biography, the English writer Samuel Johnson. After we came out of the church, we stood talking for some time together of Bishop Berkeley's ingenious sophistry to prove the non-existence of matter, and that everything in the universe is merely ideal. I observed that though we are satisfied his doctrine is not true, it is impossible to refute it. I shall never forget the alacrity with which Johnson answered, striking his foot with mighty force against a large stone till he rebounded from it. I refute it thus. So what is this ingenious sophistry? Look at it this way. You see a tree. You see it, you smell it, and if it's bearing fruit, you can taste it. You hit it, and it makes a dull sound, so you can hear the tree. You touch it, you press your hands against it, and you can feel that it has solidity and substance. You chop it down, perhaps, and see the concentric rings of its trunk. You place a leaf under a microscope and inspect its minutest details. You might now think that you know a lot about the tree, and Berkeley would admit that you do. But does your knowledge in any way go beyond your five senses? No, it doesn't. Not even when those senses are magnified by devices like the microscope. Does it help, then, to assume that underlying all your sensory experience, there is what 17th century philosophers like John Locke in England and René Descartes in France called substance? Berkeley would say that it doesn't. The essence of the tree lies in its being perceived. Physical objects are just bundles of qualities, and those qualities can exist only in so far as there is a mind to perceive them. It follows that material objects exist only if they are perceived. They can exist only in the mind, whether the mind is earthly or divine. Now, this strange view of the world grew out of a theory of how we perceive the world, which Berkeley published in 1709 as his New Theory of Vision. To tell us about that, here's Margaret Atherton, professor in philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
It's important to realize that he was preparing the new theory at exactly the same time that he was preparing the principles of human knowledge. So the fact that he was simultaneously writing what appears to be a book in psychology of space perception and a book in which he doesn't make any mention of what's come to be seen as his unusual and signature position, you know, that nothing exists but minds and ideas in those minds, is somewhat surprising. So certainly the question, you know, what is he up to here, is an excellent one. I think that what he was trying to show in the new theory was that it was possible to give a particular kind of positive account of visual space perception, that is to show how it is in fact possible to perceive distance and size and position, situation as he calls it, by sight, even though our visual system is not set up to immediately register that information. So what he was trying to do was to give a kind of, as I see it, case study in which he's showing how along the lines of the views which he's going to be developing much more substantially, we can come to understand how a particular kind of knowledge is possible.
So what is the relationship between the theory of vision and the metaphysics? I mean, the theory of vision is actually quite persuasive, and in fact it remained the orthodoxy for about 200 years, didn't it?
Well, it didn't, In fact, I think that there were bits and pieces of it that were certainly widely accepted. The part of it that Berkeley probably set the most store by was a consequence of the theory, or an underpinning of the theory, that ideas of touch and ideas of sight are entirely disparate, that they have different content, that they're heterogeneous in his terminology. And I don't think that this aspect of his theory persevered, although what did persevere is the general picture that distance perception in particular is something that we learn how to do.
Now, he moves on from this to his developed metaphysical position, but let's look at the position that he is opposing, which is the established philosophy of his English contemporary, older contemporary, John Locke. So what is Locke's view, and why is Berkeley opposed to it?
Could I say a little bit more, actually, about the presuppositions of your question?
Yeah.
Because I think that we can learn something else as well. The notebooks tell us something very interesting. They give us information that we generally don't have about philosophers of that period. They tell us who Berkeley was reading and what he was thinking about what he was reading. And so they give us a lot of information about what he had in mind and who he had in mind in developing his theory. And it's clear from a reading of the notebooks that Berkeley was casting a net quite widely back through the 17th century, and that he was focusing in initially on the ideas of people like Descartes, and then Descartes' followers like Malebranche, and to some extent he's also concerned about Spinoza. And then finally, he is of course also extremely interested in Locke. But given that his scope is as wide as it is, it becomes a little tricky to get clear about exactly how to understand the relationship between Berkeley and Locke, because I've just described to you a period and a set of positions that are by no means monolithic. We're talking about some pioneers like Descartes, and then some people trying to clean up Descartes' theory, and finally we're ending up with Locke, who was really very significantly a critic of Descartes. So the problem that we're faced with is to think about how to pull out what Berkeley got from Locke from where he's disagreeing with Locke against a background of his clear disagreement with a good deal of what Descartes and Malebranche say.
Okay, so what is his disagreement here? Where does he start to depart from Locke, let's say?
Locke himself had a kind of position that was quite contrary to Descartes, let's say. And in particular, he wanted to say, contrary to Descartes, that we shouldn't base our understanding of the world on innate, intellectually based ideas, that instead the only ideas that we could use are ideas from sensation. And Berkeley agreed with Locke about this. Locke wanted to draw the conclusion that therefore our knowledge of the natural world is significantly limited by our sensory faculties, right? And that the sorts of theoretical concepts that Descartes wanted to use, concepts describing the underlying nature of the external world, for Locke were unavailable. And Berkeley talks about that. He says Locke bantered the notion of substance, he says in his notes. So Locke is saying we can't do this sort of intellectual work that Descartes has argued that we can do. We have to make do with putting together the ideas that we get from our senses.
On ABC Radio National, you're with The Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Margaret Atherton, Associate Professor in Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, about the philosophy of the 18th century Irish philosopher George Berkeley.
Locke says the candle set up in us is great enough for our purposes. But Berkeley didn't like that part. He didn't like what looks like skeptical conclusions, and he didn't like the suggestion that we had been given a kind of limited candle. I think one way to see what Berkeley is doing is to say, well, Locke is wrong when he says that we just have to make do with observing what of our ideas go together, that in fact an understanding of the natural world just is an appreciation of the systematic connection among the ideas that we have.
So this is how he feels able to say that he's taking a common sense view of the universe. It's only philosophers who start thinking and questioning our perceptions who arrive at skeptical conclusions. But Tom, Dick and Harry, they know what they know.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, he was very obviously concerned with these long arguments that you get, for example, in Malebranche and also to some extent in Descartes, that say, well, look, all of the information that we get in from our senses, that's all mediated through our bodies. It's all, to one extent or another, a misrepresentation of the way the world is, which, you know, is good enough for us to get around by, but is misleading if we try to use it in order to understand the actual nature of the world. And what Berkeley is trying to do is to say, no, on the contrary, it's really not the case that our ideas are intended to represent something non-ideational. What our ideas represent are other ideas, and they do that just splendidly.
Let's get back to the route that he took to these conclusions. One of the things that he's very opposed to is abstraction. What did he understand by abstraction, and why was he opposed to it?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think it's not always obvious what exactly is going on in that argument. As you know, the major statement that he makes about abstraction is in the Introduction to the Principles, so he thinks that it's very important before people understand his metaphysics that they take on board his views about the impossibility of abstract ideas. But he also talks about this exact issue in the New Theory, and what he says there is, I think, also very helpful, because there what he's concerned about is to show that in our understanding of space, we're linking together visual ideas of an expanse, for example, and tangible ideas of an expanse. And those are two separate ideas. It's not the case that there's such a thing as expanse that's not visual and is not tangible. So what he says is that people get confused about that because they think that it's somehow possible to kind of peel off all of the things that make an expanse visual, like a color, or to peel off all of the things that make an expanse tangible, and to be left with some actual content. He says, you can't do that. The content is always going to come from some sense experience. So you're never going to be able to get a line, for example, that's not red and it's not blue and it's not yellow and it's not long and it's not short and it's not rough and it's not smooth. It's not any of those things. So his idea is that once we start with this understanding, which he takes over from Locke, that our ideas are all sense-based ideas, then the notion of an idea which has been abstracted from all sensory information is just incomprehensible.
He has what he calls a master argument to oppose the notion that there is a material substrate to our perceptions.
Yeah.
How does that argument work?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, too, because if you sort of read it kind of neat as a set piece, it just looks crazy. It looks completely bonkers. Because he's saying, all right, I'm going to give up everything if you can argue that it's even possible to conceive of an idea existing unperceived. And you think, well, of course I can do that. We do that all the time. You know, our whole picture of the world is of a world that exists, whether or not we're looking at it. So what's supposed to be the argument here? And when people try to come up with possible arguments, often what they come up with is clearly pretty specious. But I think the context is very tightly connected to what I was just talking about before, about the importance of his anti-abstractionism, and that what he's now addressing in this course of the argument is the question, starting from the fact that everybody agrees that we have ideas, that the external world acts on us or whatever, and we have ideas, and now the question is, what do these ideas represent? Right? Can you, in fact, intelligibly frame the hypothesis that ideas represent something non-ideational? That is a sort of material substance, for example, which is sitting out there and bumping into us, causing us to have ideas. And Berkeley's argument is no, you can't do it, because it's a hypothesis that's based on an unalleged incomprehensible mental process.
So the argument here is, can I imagine something that I'm not perceiving? And the notion is that, well, actually, no, I can't, because if I try to imagine it, then I'm already imagining that I'm perceiving that thing. It looks like a sleight of hand, doesn't it?
That certainly does look like a sleight of hand, but I think the point of it is that any kind of content that fills out the story of your perceiving the idea is going to have content deriving from your sense experience. Right, so your idea of an unperceived tree sitting in the middle of an empty field is an idea whose content consists in what that tree is like when you're looking at it, and it isn't an idea of material substance hanging out, as it were, waiting for you to loom into view.
So what Berkeley is saying is that if I imagine that there is this tree unperceived right. by me or by anybody else, I'm actually fooling myself. That I'm fooling myself about the nature of the world. I'm also fooling myself about the nature of my own perceptions.
Well, what I'm fooling myself about is the claim that the content of the idea of my imagination consists in something unperceived, because, of course, it doesn't. It consists in the ideas that you did perceive and are now remembering in order to construct your idea of the imagination.
Berkeley was active at a time of great scientific advance. He was a contemporary of Isaac Newton.
Mm-hmm.
How do his ideas influence of his view of what science should be doing, his view of scientific method?
Right, well, he argues in the Principles very, very strongly that it's his approach that supports the current, that is his current, that is Newtonian physics. And I think the picture that he has in mind is that what he's arguing against is a picture derived most specifically from Cartesian physics, where we're assuming the existence of substances with essences on which qualities depend, all of which have proved to be very difficult to pin down and to discuss and to understand. Whereas what Berkeley is saying, as he says in a passage in the third of the three dialogues, he says that according to his view of things, the more we understand about the connections of things, the more we understand about the things. So that what he's presenting is a view that he says is very explicitly Newtonian, that what Newton does is to show how it is that generalizations, laws, connections among things can be subsumed under broader and broader generalizations. Right? And that, for Berkeley, is exactly what understanding the nature of things is like.
Newton, however, I suspect would have thought that he was actually telling you what the universe was like, whereas Berkeley's committed, isn't he, to a view that these days we might call instrumentalist. That's to say that science is basically about, not about giving causal explanations of the universe, it's right. about ordering our perceptions, just giving some sort of structure to our perceptions of the world.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that Newton himself certainly wouldn't have immediately embraced Berkeley's attempt to help him out. And Newton was never completely happy with the way in which he was able to talk, for example, about universal gravitation and in a way which left it unpinned from any obvious set of causal mechanisms. But Berkeley thinks that he's really helping Newton. He's giving Newton a helping hand by giving a better understanding of the kind of transition that Newton has provided for us from Cartesian essences to Newtonian laws.
Berkeley thinks that he's giving Newton a hand. He thinks he's giving common sense, the man in the street, as it were, a hand with his metaphysics. Nobody thanked him, did they? His views were widely regarded as weird and paradoxical, kind of difficult to refute, but not acceptable.
Yes and no, I mean, it is true that you don't find in this world a whole lot of Berkeleyans. I'm not sure in this world you find a whole lot of, Lockeans either, for that matter, or even today a whole lot of Cartesians, although there were more of them at the time. I think that actually Berkeley has had a better run than you might think. There certainly have been people, if you trace the history of Berkeley reception, who have been able to appreciate the more positive elements in Berkeley's account, the sort of positive elements I've just been stressing in talking about Newton. That is, the way in which we can come to understand that, in fact, we've got exactly what we do need in order to understand the natural world. Right, and that any attempt to try to provide some sort of metaphysical or causal underpinning is just going to lead us astray. So I think that while Berkeley is often misunderstood and is taken solely as holding bizarre ontological theories, the fact that he's making very positive claims about how, by understanding the natural world as a language, we can appreciate the way in which we can understand it, in which we can discriminate between what's real and what's unreal, for example, hasn't gone unappreciated.
So we see him ultimately, do we, as somebody who asked important questions. We don't necessarily accept his answers, but we see him as somebody who asked questions that needed to be asked.
Well, I would certainly want to push that, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Margaret Atherton, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Margaret Atherton is professor in philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with more idealism.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.